Hey, I'm Brian Stelter, live in New York on a very poignant Mother's Day. This is Reliable Sources, where we examine the story behind the story, and we find out what's reliable. This hour, a White House source telling me that President Biden is livid about these intel leaks. So were the news outlets right or wrong to publish? Plus, books stacking up against Donald Trump. His former defense secretary is the latest author. We're going to tell you why Mark Esper had to sue his old department to get this book published. And later, the media frenzy around the Johnny Depp Amber Heard trial, why these alerts and memes and posts are unavoidable. There's a lot to get to, but first, one of the biggest scoops in American journalism history. And it was about one of the most polarizing issues in history. We knew the Supreme Court would be ruling on abortion this summer. We knew the conservative majority could roll back Roe v. Wade. We knew this would be a big story in late June. But through Politico's sensational scoop, it has landed early. This report from Monday night about the draft majority opinion, dated February, is by far the most viewed article in Politico's history. It is still dominating news nearly a week later. So this hour, we're going to size up the media coverage with several unique voices, including a former CBS reporter turned Planned Parenthood director and a host on a Catholic news network. But let's begin by going behind the scenes of the Politico bombshell that started it all with one of Politico's top editors, Daphna Linzer. She is the outlet's executive editor, and she's with me now. Daphna, tell me about the moment when you found out that your reporters had obtained this draft majority opinion. What happened?
Well, they were working very hard, our reporters, Josh Gerstein and Alex Ward, to try and confirm what they had and to try and understand it. And our role was to kind of help them and support them so that they could verify the information, understand the context in the moment, as you said, and then get ready to publish.
It seems to me there was a several-day process. I know you're not talking about the timeline in detail, but the White House Correspondents' Dinner was this time last week, and Politico had a big brunch this time last Sunday. And when you were there, you knew this was in the works. Is that right?
You know, it was a kind of extraordinary moment that we were gathering sort of in person for the first time with colleagues from across Washington to celebrate the First Amendment, which is what that dinner is really about. We did publish the next day, the next evening, Monday evening. There was just a few of us in the newsroom that evening. A lot of people still working remotely. So it was quite a moment.
Did you all ever hesitate about publishing? In other words, was there ever a scenario where you would not have published a story about this draft ruling?
I think for us, Brian, there were just two issues for us. Is the document authentic? Do we understand it? And is it in the public interest? Once we knew it was authentic, we knew it was in the public interest, and we were ready to go.
You were 100% sure it was authentic before you published?
We were.
You were. And the story referred to some sort of source saying that the vote count had not changed since February. That implies someone was feeding information that was current, not just from February, but was current. Can you say whether your reporters are still in touch with that source?
I can't talk about the sourcing or that timeline or any aspect of that. I can say that Alex Ward and Josh Gerstein are very seasoned reporters. It's a very seasoned newsroom, reporters with deep experience, and they felt comfortable that we understood not just the draft opinion, but that moment. And understanding that moment was key to understanding where the court was at the time that we were ready to go.
Mm. Chief Justice John Roberts announced a leak investigation. He called the leak absolutely appalling. Has Politico been contacted by the court or by authorities investigating the leak?
We have not. And honestly, we don't know more about the investigation than has been made public so far.
Do you expect you will be investigated or pursued?
You know, the chief did not mention publication in his statement, and we don't see any evidence of a crime here.
Because you obtained a document, you published it, it's legit. And so what now? What is Politico working on now? I mean, well, let me ask you this, Daphna. Was the reaction as intense as you expected? What did you expect on Monday night when you hit publish?
Yeah, you know, I think we were all fully aware of just how unprecedented something like this is, to be able to peek inside internal deliberations of the Supreme Court, which is not exactly the most transparent branch of government. And getting a good sense of that, we understood. And as you said, I think, Brian, at the beginning, you talked about how polarizing this is. I think we understood that this was a story, very much a Politico story, actually, because it is as meaningful and as important to people across the political spectrum, that people feel as passionate and invested in the outcome of this case, regardless of their party affiliation.
And there are lots of arguments about the leak, but I don't see people calling out Politico for publishing. It seems like everybody wanted to know what was happening, and you all have given us a preview. Here's one argument. I saw an headline saying, you know, this is good that the Supreme Court's veil of secrecy has been punctured. Do you suspect, and this is a Politico's Jack Schaefer saying that, do you think that's going to happen more often now? You know, is this going to be the new normal for Supreme Court rulings?
It's hard to say. I mean, I'm not really in the prediction business. We did publish, on the night that we published the story, Josh Kirstein had a really important accompanying piece looking at the history of leaks at the Supreme Court. Never one quite like this. But certainly there have been sort of tea leaves and leaks in the past. I do think that the public, again, you know, has this very clear right to know about what's happening, and I don't know how that's going to impact the court and how it proceeds going forward.
What's your number one note about the media coverage going forward? You know, you just joined Politico, you've been at NBC and other outlets. Put on your media critic hat for me. What do we need to put front and center as we cover reproductive rights in the months to come?
Yeah, I think this is a story, you know, again, Politico is going to own, already has owned it, and will cover it from every angle. It's obviously a very passionate topic across the country. People are, as I said, equally invested on both sides, and I think that's something to keep in mind.
Absolutely. Thank you, Daphna. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Brian.
Let's bring in some members of our media panel now. Washington Post media reporter Elahe Izadi is with me, and CNN media critic Brian Lowry. Elahe, you wrote about the power of language in the abortion fight. Also did a podcast about that this week. The power of language. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so when we talk about how media covers really fraught topics such as abortion, the way in which it's framed, even the words that we use to describe any side of a debate, are really consequential. So when it comes to abortion, for many years, the media adopted the language and nomenclature of pro-life, which was something that activists on that side of the debate really wanted to be cast as. But, you know, this week I had a podcast episode with my colleague, Margaret Sullivan, who's a media columnist, and she made the point that when we talk about pro-life in those terms, then what is the opposite side of pro-life? Anti-life? And, you know, a lot of media organizations, mainstream media organizations in recent years no longer use that language. They use abortion rights or anti-abortion rights language because they say that that's more precise to what we're talking about. But still, that language is still quite common, and it partly has to do with how we allow people, when our sources, to define themselves. You know, we do defer to people and how they like to be referred to. But it does shape our understanding of what an issue is really about.
And those activists know a lot about the subject. They are deeply invested. But many Americans do not know the details. Let me show some points made by Amelia Thompson DeVoe of 538. She said, Americans' views on abortion are confusing because they don't know much about it. They don't know how pregnancies progress. They don't know when abortions happen. They don't know who gets abortions. They don't know what will happen in their state if Roe is gone. She went on to say, Americans don't know much about this because they don't like to think about it. They don't like the politics. They don't like the debate. I thought that was really spot on. People don't like to think about something like this. And a lot of folks don't frankly know the details about reproduction and about reproductive rights. So, Elahe, that seems to me to be a challenge for the media. There's some education to do.
Yeah, and on top of it, I would perhaps put forward that a lot of lawmakers maybe are confused about some of those very topics. And so it does become confusing. And, you know, this is an issue in which there is a group of activists who feel very strongly about, and they've been working for decades on this issue, and they're very passionate about it. There are voters who only vote on this issue, but for large segments of the population, they're not thinking about it as much or in such passionate terms. And so it does become, you know, and if it doesn't impact you, then maybe you aren't thinking about it. Maybe you aren't educating yourself. And, you know, in some of these states, their abortion is already restricted so heavily, places like Oklahoma and Texas, and that provides a preview of what's to come for the rest of the country.
So I've been doing a lot of reading in the last few days. I think many of us have. Brian Lowry, our CNN media critic. I was reading this morning a Los Angeles Times story about women in Texas making those choices about how to get an abortion or whether they still can, given the state's heartbeat law. Here's what I thought was missing in the story, Brian Lowry. Men. You know what word I think is missing in the news coverage of this? Sex. I went through and looked at the transcripts on cable news this week. Almost no one talks about what causes abortion, what leads to the point of abortion. Brian Lowry, it takes two to tango. But where are the men? Where's the conversation about men and about sex and what's causing this in the first place? Seems to me that's a missing part of a story.
Well, I think that's true. And I think you've seen it's basically been limited to jokes and memes. You know, if men were subject to abortion laws, this would happen. We really haven't seen not only what it means for women, but what it also means for men. What it means for men. I've seen a few people point to this, what it means for men if women bring children to term that they don't want. But that hasn't been covered enough. And I think the other thing that really hasn't been covered enough, I just watched a documentary that premiered at Sundance called The Janes, which is about an underground abortion network that existed before Roe. And those women are alive. You know, those Roe was 49 years ago, but that's in many people's lifetimes. And I don't think we've heard enough voices yet, and we probably will. But, watching that documentary, it really felt like there was an opportunity. We tend to talk about this issue in abstract terms. We see people compare it to The Handmaid's Tale and things like that. But there is real world examples of what it was like in America before Roe versus Wade that can be shared and pointed out to people, and I think would really add a great deal to the discussion.
Right, that's a great point. Let me bring in our other panelist, David French. We were having some tech problems earlier, but he's here with us now. David French, senior editor for The Dispatch and host of the Good Faith podcast. David, what would you add here about media coverage of what appears to be an impending rollback of abortion rights, at least in many states in the U.S.? What do you want people to keep in mind about how this should be covered in the months ahead?
Yeah, you know, I think how it should be covered is informing people first and foremost, because one of the things that we see is that, as was just mentioned, folks don't even know what it means when you say, should Roe v. Wade be overturned? Right. So that, for example, is a virtually useless poll question, because they often interpret it as, should abortion be banned or not banned, which is not what Roe v. Wade is about. It's whether or not, it's who decides. Is it decided by justices of the Supreme Court, or is it decided by voters, even either through Congress or through their state legislatures? So there's just an enormous amount of work that has to be done to educate people about what the issues are. And I think also the media needs some education as well. I think the media class is much more intensely focused on this issue than a lot of the rest of Americans, because you're seeing in the polling some rather interesting things that seem to be not really tracking with each other. So for example, there was a CNN poll that indicated strong American support for at least some degree of abortion rights, but also strong American support for the GOP in the midterm elections. And the GOP is the party that is the pro-life party, Democrats' pro-choice party. And so how can that be if there's strong support for abortion rights amongst Americans and they're going to vote Republican? That tells us a lot about relative intensity. How much do people care about this issue? And I think sometimes the media, because it's so glued to Twitter, often misses the fact that abortion is really downstream from a lot of people's lives in the United States of America. We're part of this American class that's super focused on this issue, and an awful lot of Americans are not.
I agree with that, and I think many people don't want to think about it until they're confronted by it when it's national news. There's a lot more here, so let's everybody stick around, take a quick break here. Coming up, we're going to get into the handoff, the latest on this handoff at the White House, the press secretary podium. But first, 1 year ago, she was a CBS News reporter. Now she works for Planned Parenthood. what Kate Smith has to say about the media's coverage of Roe v. Wade. She is up next.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature-balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
I'm sorry that the Great Barrier Reef is no longer great, that we value Amazon much more than the Amazon, and that the waterfront neighborhood where you were growing up could be condemned by rising seas before you're old enough to apply for a mortgage.
That's my friend Bill Weir, CNN's chief climate correspondent. He's optimistic about the planet, and he's optimistic about our ability to take care of it. Listen to Chasing Life wherever you get your podcasts.
With the Supreme Court set to overturn Roe v. Wade, according to that Politico scoop, you'd think that right-wing media outlets and anti-abortion activists would be celebrating. But there's been, in some quarters, a downplaying of the news and a focus instead on the leak. There's also this factor here from the Washington Post. Religious leaders more divided on abortion than some Americans might think. And here's another headline saying this is and is not the moment that pro-life evangelicals have been waiting for. We're even seeing some Christians turn to TikTok to preach about being pro-choice. On the Eternal Word television network, the slogan is Live Truth, Live Catholic. The Catholic News Channel even has a weekly show focused on the pro-life movement. One of the anchors with EWTN is Monse Alvarado. She's the host of EWTN's News in Depth, and she joins us now. Thanks for coming on the program.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
I'd just love to know. I think that sometimes there's not enough awareness or attention on religious media in the U.S. I'd love to know how your network is covering this big bombshell news this week.
You know, Brian, I love the discussion you were just having because you're right. A lot of people don't want to talk about this issue. They don't want to talk about abortion. They're uncomfortable. But this is a discussion that religious news outlets, EWTN in particular, has not been shy about talking about. And they didn't wait for the egregious Supreme Court leak to start this discussion. They've had it since this case was taken on. EWTN had a series called Life After Roe, Debate in the States, talking about what happens in every single one of these states when Roe is overturned and defining what Roe is, explaining to people, just like David French said, they don't know what happens when Roe is overturned. They don't understand what happens in their local community. And so we want to look at those real stories and let people make up their own minds. Finding the truth, like you said, that is our mission with the Catholic Lens.
I noticed that you have been doing that series for weeks already, preparing viewers for this likelihood. Do you view what you do as a pro-life, as anti-abortion, period? Do you advocate for a national ban through the Senate and the House in the years to come?
The life issue is so complicated, but the Catholic Church makes no mistakes about this. Pro-life is pro-life. Life is life. It begins in the womb. Everybody knows that. Making the decision about abortion is one that has been tainted by misinformation from the right and from the left. And that's the goal of EWTN, is bringing out that truth. Mother Angelica founded this network, a woman founded this network, to be able to share the truth with people. And that's what's missing in the media today. And that's why EWTN is so important.
What's the misinformation from the right?
The misinformation from the right, I think that even saying that the leak is a full ban on abortion, telling people that Roe versus Wade is when this is over, that's a big, big, big mistake that the media is making. Telling people that that's where the fight ends. It doesn't end there. That's the beginning of a discussion that has been stilted. The democratic process stopped on this issue the moment that Roe was decided by seven men.
And you're saying when we talk about pro-life, it also means taking care of the families, helping people,
Absolutely.
Supporting them. But
Absolutely.
Do you actually trust Republicans to follow through on that?
Republicans, Democrats, you have Democrats who are pro-life as well, who want to see families taken care of. Kristen Day is always on TV shows telling people, listen to Democrats who want to be a part of this party and feel completely excluded.
Do you, as we talk about this in the past few days, and many people are getting up to speed for the first time, can you see why many women, and some men for that matter, are afraid that IUDs and IVF will be threatened in the years to come?
There is fear, I think, on both sides. If you look at Catholic churches this morning, they had people standing outside their doors, fearing that someone would come in and have a sit-in or even provoke violence in their masses, their Mother's Day masses today, because people are fearful. Like I mentioned, on both sides, again, from lack of information. Mm. They don't understand what's happening here. They're scared. Emotions are raging. And it's the role of the media to slow
down. It's not just lack of information, right, Monse? It's also Republican lawmakers passing legislation that would cause IUDs or even IVF to be at risk.
Do you really think that this is only the Republican Party? You don't think that there's fear-mongering on both sides? The nice thing about being at a Catholic network is I don't have to look at things through a political lens. I don't have a political agenda. EWTN is focused on Catholicity, the Catholic faith. And so we don't need to pander to one side or the other. We just
need to focus on the
truth. Including
the many Catholics who do seek out abortion?
Many Catholics who have suffered abortion, many Catholics who don't understand the beginning and the end of life, who need a network like EWTN to share that information with them.
As I said, it is very complicated, and you're showing us that. Thank you, Monse. Thanks for coming on.
Very complicated. Thank you so much for having me.
Now to another personal story with a unique twist. For several years, Kate Smith was a reporter for CBS News, and part of her beat, for a while, all of her beat was reproductive rights. She filed News of Day reports and long-form documentaries. One even took her to El Salvador, where abortion is illegal. Last summer, she decided to leave CBS, and she's now working for Planned Parenthood as the senior director of news content. And Kate Smith joins me now. Kate, why'd you leave CBS News last year?
There's a few different reasons why I left CBS News, but I think most relevant to this conversation is that at the time, my editor was no longer interested in covering abortion policy and sexual reproductive health as a dedicated beat, which is something that I had spent so much time learning and becoming an expert in. And so when I was thinking the next steps of my career, having that off the table, I was more willing to consider other options.
I think we need more reporters on that beat, not fewer, but okay. So tell us, what does the senior director of news content at Planned Parenthood do? What's your job?
So abortion policy, sexual reproductive health, it's often covered, it's a local news story, but it's often covered with a national news frame. So when you read a story, say, about Texas's six-week abortion ban, you know, you're going to get a quote in there from Ted Cruz. You're going to get the size and scope of how many abortion bans have been passed, that kind of thing. But for the patient who wakes up that morning and wants to know whether or not they still have an appointment, that's the kind of news that they need delivered. And I tell you, in that article, I promise you, she's not going to be able to figure out whether or not her appointment is on. And I tell you that because I was a reporter who was writing those stories for CBS, and I can't tell you how many DMs I got, how many emails I got, how many phone calls I got from these patients who were asking me, hey, I saw your article about this six-week ban. Like, can you walk me through whether or not I have an appointment today? And then I can tell you today, after that leak on Monday, our Planned Parenthood health centers, we have been flooded with calls from people who are concerned about their birth control appointments, are concerned about their abortion appointments. There's a lot of, because of the way that we cover abortion in the media, with this national frame, often it's a political story. We're leaving patients out of the equation. So at Planned Parenthood, as, you know, doing news content, what we want to do is we want to solve for that. If you want to understand what your rights are right now, come to Planned Parenthood. We're the experts. Like, think about cancer, for example. If you wanted to understand, you know, cancer treatments, you'd rather go to Sloan Kettering's content than a New York Times article, right?
Ah, okay. That's interesting. That makes sense. Last year, though, National Review, the conservative outlet, called you, or 2 years ago, Planned Parenthood ambassador to CBS. They said you were posing as a reporter and constructing articles that more closely resemble press releases than news. So that was the charge when you were at CBS, and now you're at Planned Parenthood. How do you react to the conservatives who say you were biased in your CBS coverage?
Look, if you're a blogger online, you might not realize all of the different layers that someone goes through before they publish a piece, before they go on air. We have standards, we have lawyers. Before anything goes on air, there's been a thorough review of what's been going on. So I stand by every article I write. And I would say that making that accusation, you're playing into the right. Anyone who doesn't fall by their rules, who doesn't who is an anti-abortion, is against them. So if you're trying to cover this from a neutral point of view and you're including both sides, they automatically think you are against them because they view doctors for abortion, and they view them as biased, even though these are doctors we're talking about. So I really reject all of that criticism. Again, I think these people just don't understand how newsrooms actually work. They don't have that kind of experience. But yeah, completely reject that criticism.
While at CBS, I mentioned your trip to El Salvador. What did you learn there, and how does it relate to the U.S. now?
Yeah, that reporting trip to El Salvador was really eye-opening, and it really helped me put together the pieces of what I was seeing on the ground happening. And at the time, the reporting trip was in 2019, so none of these six-week abortion bans, the really extreme ones that you see, had gone into place yet. And we were only hearing from doctors and politicians about what might happen if an abortion ban were to go into effect. When we went to El Salvador, what we saw is all of those things that these doctors and politicians had warned us about were happening in real time on the ground. I spoke to a doctor who, in no uncertain terms, told me that he has had patients die because he wasn't allowed to give them an abortion that would have saved their lives. We met with a doctor who was giving abortions illegally, and he was saying there's been absolutely no difference in demand for abortions, whether it's legal or not. There's no difference. And then most, really keeps me up at night is when I spoke to the women who were in prison for having an abortion. And there were some in there who had not seen their family in years because this prison is in such a dangerous place that their family can't visit. Mm. And they say they had a miscarriage and they woke up, they had an obstetric emergency, and they wake up and they are shackled to the hospital bed, and there is a police officer in there investigating them. And I can tell you, the doctors told me when they are looking at a patient, there is no way for them to tell the difference between an induced abortion and a spontaneous miscarriage. You can't tell the difference. That is a medical fact. And so, it's just up to a judge to decide. And these people were saying they were innocent. And as a proof point, many of those women who were in prison, they have since been released because there wasn't enough evidence to put them in prison. So again, all of these things that we, say might happen if abortion gets banned, if abortion becomes illegal, they do happen. This isn't a theory. We don't need to speculate. We have actual facts that can inform what happens.
Kate, thank you very much. Thanks for being here. Leaks, they're definitely a theme this week, from the Supreme Court now to the battleground in Ukraine. Why are anonymous U.S. officials bragging about sharing intel with Ukraine that caused Russian deaths? We're going to get into that with David French in just a moment. And this just into CNN, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has become the latest head of state to visit Ukraine, his office now confirming that he's there to meet with Ukraine's president. Further details to come. The U.S. First Lady Jill Biden also traveled to the country earlier today and met with the Ukrainian First Lady. We'll have more on this later in the day here on CNN. We have to talk about the leaks this week, including reporting from the New York Times claiming that U.S. intelligence has been helping Ukraine kill Russian generals. The White House pushed back on that framing, calling the headline misleading, saying the story was irresponsible. There's also been leaks from the intel community, it seems, about the U.S. providing intelligence that helped Ukraine target Russia's prized warship, the Moskva. NBC reported the president called his top U.S. intel and defense officials and urged them to plug the leaks. New York Times columnist Tom Friedman reporting, quote, I'm told that he called the director of national intelligence, director of the CIA, and the secretary of defense to make clear in the strongest language that this kind of loose talk is reckless and has got to stop immediately. I'm told the same by a White House source, that the president was livid about these leaks. Joining me now, senior editor for The Dispatch, contributing writer for The Atlantic, David French. David, are news outlets right or wrong to publish the information they are told by these anonymous U.S. officials?
Yeah, I think this fits within a news outlet's fundamental news gathering function. Look, there are circumstances in which I think an administration can go to a news outlet and say, this is an absolute matter of life and death, establish it's a matter of life and death or the near equivalent, and a news outlet can responsibly say no. But what we're talking about here is the conduct of a nation and the conduct of our intelligence agencies in one of the most important stories, the most important, arguably, story in the world right now. And I think what's important here is that I'm seriously doubtful that this is news to the Russians. If you're talking about the ability of Ukrainians to uncannily target key targets, Russian military targets, That is something that logic suggests is sort of outside of the capability of the Ukrainian military acting alone. I do think the main problem, as a practical matter, with the leak is the sense that the administration or administration officials are bragging about it, that that's something that they're trying to sort of throw into Russia's face, what they are doing, or take political credit or credit in the court of public opinion for their actions in the war. And I think that's where it gets a bit more dangerous, because what's happening is they're essentially dunking on the Russians in public, so to speak. But as far as would Russia have any idea that we were doing this before the leak, I think that's just fiction.
I see. So these are anonymous leaks. We're also getting on-the-record confirmation about some chaos from the Trump years, thanks to Mark Esper's upcoming book. Let's take a look at this. His book comes out on Tuesday. He was, of course, the former Secretary of Defense. And in the book, there's a lot in the book, one of the revelations is that Esper claims then-President Trump asked him in 2020 about launching missiles into Mexico to destroy the drug labs and kill cartels. Maybe Trump thought he could do it and Mexico wouldn't know, and Esper had to talk him down. But, you know, here we are, David, yet another incredible revelation from the Trump years, this time on the record from the former Secretary of Defense. And he had to sue to get his book to be published, because there's this Pentagon pre-publication process where his book was held up. And according to CNN's Oliver Darcy, this is what held it up. They didn't want this drug lab detail to come out. So he sued. Now the book is coming out. Tell us about that process, though, that the Defense Department had to review his book first. Is it possible they were trying to stop embarrassing news about Trump from getting out?
Well, that's not the intent of the review process, although sometimes that's the effect of the review process or the way that the review process is distorted. The intent is pretty obvious and makes sense, in that if you're a person who is exposed to an avalanche of secret information, there need to be steps taken in classified information. There need to be steps taken to make sure that classified information doesn't enter the public domain. But it is not a process that is supposed to be protective of the president's political reputation or save a president from embarrassment. Embarrassing moments aren't classified because they're embarrassing. And so I think that oftentimes when you do have a pre-publication review process, one that's sensibly designed to prevent a leaking of classified information that could damage national security, it can often morph into something else, a process designed to prevent embarrassment.
I see. Well, the book is out Tuesday. We're going to see it for ourselves. David French, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Up next, what CNN's brand new CEO wants this network to do.
The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish. There's been a ton of writing about the album Cowboy Carter since it dropped this spring. But what grabbed my attention is a new documentary on CNN called Call Me Country, Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Lots of artists have tried to boot scoot their way onto country music charts. Why did this album cause such a stir? And what about both this pop star and this political moment has caused all this conversation? Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
A big change at the White House. A new face behind the podium in the press briefing room. Jen Psaki announcing her departure as expected and naming her successor, Karine Jean-Pierre, currently the White House's principal deputy press secretary. She will step into the official press secretary role when Psaki departs in this coming week. Jean-Pierre, seen on Friday at this year's GLAAD Awards, she'll become the first Black and out LGBTQ person to hold the position of White House press secretary. She's no stranger to the media, of course. She's already filled in for Psaki several times, so she's a logical choice. What will this mean for the White House? Let's bring our media panel in for a conversation about that and more. Elahi Azadi of The Washington Post is with me, Brian Lowry of CNN, and NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Elahi, this is a logical move for the White House, but it is notable given her background, her trailblazing status. This comes when there are debates about gay rights, when there are anti-LGBTQ laws being passed in many states, and Jean-Pierre now taking over later this month.
Yeah, this is definitely a history-making moment, but as the new press secretary has said, when she came out to talk about her appointment in this role, that she acknowledges the history being made, but she tried to pivot and say, you know, everyone who's here at the White House, we're here on behalf of the American people. And, you know, the Biden administration has made these sort of history-making moves before. It will be interesting to see this new press secretary in this role at a time when issues around LGBTQ rights are coming to the forefront in media coverage, but especially on the state's level. And also, you know, we were expecting Jen Psaki to leave the post for some time. She's rumored to be going to MSNBC. We'll see if that's the case. But yeah, it does make sense as far as who would take the mantle. And you know, Jen Psaki, when she came into the role, she made her whole point to sort of restore the, you know, the protocol or the quote unquote civility that had been absent from the briefing room during the Trump administration. And, yeah. you know, her briefings don't make cable news the way that they did during the Trump administration. So
That's
I would
point.
Expect nothing to change in that regard.
Staying on the cable news point, Karine's partner is Suzanne Malveaux, a CNN correspondent here. So I asked CNN about that possible conflict of interest. And here's the statement. Suzanne will continue in her role as CNN national correspondent, covering national, international news and cultural events, but will not cover politics. That's the statement. Not cover politics, Capitol Hill, or the White House while Karine is serving as press secretary. So that's CNN. Let's go to the MSNBC angle. Psaki is going to be joining MSNBC this fall. She hasn't signed the deal yet since she's still at the White House, but she is going to MSNBC. Is there a possibility, Brian Lowry, that she plays a role at 9 p.m.? Rachel Maddow, as of this week, is only hosting on Mondays, so MSNBC has a big 9 p.m. vacancy.
Well, that's a possibility. I mean, that would be a really big promotion. That would be a big jump. You know, we've seen, I always liken in a way to cable news, people from going from government and politics into cable news to be coaches going from the sidelines straight to the broadcast booth. And some of them can make that transition easily and some of them do not. And it would be a huge gamble, I think, to take someone who really hasn't had the experience. There is a unique skill to hosting one of these shows. And I think taking someone straight from that and putting them in that, you know, Nicole Wallace has blossomed into a very accomplished anchor, but I think that's a learning curve.
I agree with you. I'm glad you think this job looks hard. I'm glad you think so, Brian Lowry. CNN, 9 p.m. vacancy as well. The new CNN CEO, Chris Licht, who started work on Monday, he said he plans to have a new 9 p.m. show installed in the fall. I want to read part of Licht's memo to CNN staffers. I think it's interesting about where this network is heading. He said, quote, sadly, too many people have lost trust in the news media. I think we can be a beacon in regaining that trust by exemplifying the best characteristics in journalism, fearlessly speaking truth to power, challenging the status quo, questioning groupthink, and educating viewers and readers with straightforward facts and insightful commentary while always being respectful of differing viewpoints. First and foremost, he wrote, we should and we will be advocates for truth. Eric Deggans, you're a non-CNN voice here. Anything stand out to you about that?
Well, you know, we have heard that Chris and the new bosses at Warner Brothers Discovery are interested in a CNN that's more focused on news coverage and less focused on opinion. And so this seems sort of in line with that. I've known Chris since he was executive producer of CBS This Morning, and he's also someone who's known for hiring talented people or and letting them do their jobs, which is a little different way of going about things than the previous guy in the top job, Jeff Zucker. So it will be interesting to see how far he lets the people underneath him take some of these coverage ideas and coverage decisions. You were talking about the 9 p.m. slot, and Chris has said that he wants to do some experimentation over the summer before landing on a permanent choice this fall. What's interesting to me is that, you know, at MSNBC in particular, I haven't seen a lot of consternation over developing someone to take that job. And so I wonder if the cable news channels aren't shifting a little more and more focused on online. We've seen Meet the Press, for example, is going to have a show that's on NBC News Now, their ad-supported, you know, news network, digital network. So, you know, I'm wondering if there's a less of an emphasis on linear television in general here.
Still popular and still profitable, though. And my favorite part of Licht's memo is about challenging groupthink, questioning groupthink. That would be a benefit for viewers. All right, stand by, everybody. More in a moment, including the Johnny Depp Amber Heard trial and why it's causing such a media frenzy. Johnny Depp versus Amber Heard seems to be everywhere. The trial in Virginia is spawning hashtags. TikToks, memes, and lots of live coverage, wall-to-wall on multiple channels and streaming services. Of course, this is a high-wattage trial between formerly married actors, big celebrities. It's understandable there's a lot of media interest, but there's a public spectacle aspect to it that seems uncomfortable to a lot of people. So I want to ask my guests about that. The panel is back here with me, Brian Lowry, as well, Eric Deggans, and Alahe Izadi. My chair is breaking as I'm talking to y'all, so that's why I'm stumbling. So, Brian Lowry, while I fix my chair, let me ask you, what is what's the unique quality about this trial? What do you see going on in the coverage?
Well, what I really see is that this is one of those situations where the audience is leading the media as opposed to the other way around. If you look at this story and you're privy to that kind of information, this is near the top of search. Amber Heard, Johnny Depp, every single day. Often above other, major stories. So, because this is a relatively modern occurrence that we get real-time data on what people are searching for, what people are looking for, and that includes newspapers as well as, TV networks and digital operations, they're feeding that appetite. So this is really a case where I think news organizations, we often think of them being monolithic and making decisions. In this case, they're giving the people what they seem to want.
The audience driving the media. Alahe, do you feel that? You haven't been covering this trial specifically, but do you feel that on the media beat and previously the Styles beat?
Yeah, so we've been covering the trial every single day in part in Washington Post. It's taking place in Fairfax, Virginia, not far away. And what our coverage is showing, too, is that this whole spectacle is taking place at the courthouse. I mean, in some ways, this right. is a local story for us. You have throngs of Johnny Depp fans coming out, trying to pack the court there. They have to line up early to get wristbands to get in. So, whereas maybe something like this, you would think take place in California, maybe there would be a camera allowed. In this case, the judge had discretion and chose to allow cameras. And now we're having in our own backyard of the Washington Post, this sort of spectacle unfold. So right. I know we've been covering it in that way as well.
Yeah, it's a local story. Eric, how do you think people should process these cameras and courtroom events when these trials become like entertainment vehicles?
Yeah, it is a sort of odd to see this story explode, particularly across social media. And what has often happened is that because the trial itself is long and can be tedious, what people are doing is grabbing little bits and pieces and then adding their own spin to it and posting it on social media. We're seeing it on TikTok. We're seeing it on YouTube. We're seeing it on Instagram. And so people who are not actually watching the trial may have a really distorted idea of what's actually happening, depending on which source that they get their information from or which clip they watch. And so it's been interesting to watch the different testimonies sort of sliced and diced. And I think Johnny Depp, by testifying first, got a real head start on public opinion. And so I think Amber Heard is having a hard time now because he's had the ability to sort of set, the agenda as far as what the arguments are.
Thank you, everybody, for the conversation. Quick correction, by the way. Earlier, I called Justin Trudeau the head of state, but of course, he's the head of government. Queen Elizabeth is the head of state in Canada. Thank you to the viewers who wrote in to tell me. Happy Mother's Day to my mom, my mother-in-law, my wife, Jamie, and to all you moms watching right now. State of the Union with Jake Tapper is up next.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
You can now watch CNN's Five Things on Max. Each weekday, Kate Baldwin breaks down the five essential news stories in 5 minutes or less. She'll get you up to speed and on with your day. CNN's Five Things with Kate Baldwin, streaming weekdays exclusively on Max.